yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-3105, United States of America versus Joshua Gazzola. Mr. Smith for appellant, Ms. Schmidt for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Jerry Smith for Joshua Godoy. Your Honors, I realize both government counsel and I take, because we, in my brief and my reply brief, I talk about the statement of reasons form that the judge had issued after Mr. Godoy's sentencing. We had gone to great care to make sure that we didn't file any public documents that actually contained the statement of reasons, since it's not a document for public disclosure, and took great care in our filings not to expressly quote what was in the statement of reasons. Stupidly, I didn't realize until I walked in here this morning and saw a crowd full of people that I was going to end up talking about the statement of reasons in open court in front of people. I'm not sure how that affects things, but the form is a document. Perhaps I should have filed a motion to seal, but I didn't. Frankly, it didn't even occur to me until I came in today and saw the crowd of people that I was going to be having to present this in open court. I'm not sure how to deal with that. But I did want to alert the court.
Do you need to quote from it? We've all read it.
I don't need to quote from it, and perhaps if the court would bear with me, I can dance around.
Why don't we just try to avoid quotes unless one of the three of us...
I believe that can be done, if the court would bear with me. And I'm not sure if that's what interests the court in thinking about this issue. I thought that there were probably two interests that the court wanted to hear oral arguments on. One is probably what effect to give to the statements that the judge, to the reasons that the judge had indicated in his statement of reasons. And the other one I realized the court might be interested in is to what extent the appellate waiver that was contained in Mr. Godoy's plea agreement, the enforceability of that. I was thinking the court might be interested in that. I'm willing to tailor my arguments to whatever the court would like to hear me on.
Well, why don't you start by telling us what's ambiguous about what the sentencing judge said at the sentencing, at the oral pronouncement.
He said
he was going above the guidelines because, quote, I do not feel that 41 months is enough punishment, so I'm going upwards.
He did say
that. What's ambiguous about that?
There's nothing ambiguous, I guess, about that.
Isn't that kind of the end of the case then?
For two reasons, no. One is he did say, I don't feel that 41 months is enough punishment.
Yeah.
He also said other things, though, that the 60-month sentence that he arrived at was not based purely upon punishment. He spoke about, you know, the need for rehabilitation. That was one of the factors.
But doesn't he have to?
He does, but obviously rehabilitation had factored in.
Did he link any of those to incarceration?
He did talk about how Mr. Godoy was a very sick person and how he needed intensive psychiatric treatment.
All of which are things that are appropriate to talk about in sentencing. The issue, as I understand it, is whether he said anything about incarceration that might be inappropriate under...
The only thing he expressly linked to incarceration was he ordered him while incarcerated to do intensive drug treatment. And linked that to incarceration. Now, he didn't necessarily link...
He didn't lengthen the sentence in order to make him eligible for it, which was the problem in Ray Seal case.
No, I'm not saying he did that.
Isn't that fair to say that most of your argument is based on what he said in the statement of reasons and not in what he said at sentencing? In fact, I understood your...
I think.
That's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
Your first brief is almost... acknowledges that he didn't really say anything during the sentencing hearing that was a problem. The problem is in the statement of reasons. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. I think he did say some things to indicate at the sentencing hearing in a very offhanded way that once you saw the statement of reasons and then with hindsight were able to go back and look at it, which seemed to indicate to me that he did in fact increase his sentence for the impermissible reasons that I mentioned in my brief.
So can we talk about the statement of reasons then?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So the form, I have to say, I'm a little confused about what the purpose of the form is as well. The judge did not check off the section that would have been an upward departure under the guidelines, correct?
Right. He did. He was not departing from the guidelines. He was varying from the guidelines.
Oh, it's a variance.
It's
based
a variance.
On the fact that after the Supreme Court's opinion, the guidelines are only advisory, right?
I think that's clear, Your Honor.
So in that section, the section says, the title is Court Determinations for Sentence Outside the Advisory Guidelines System. So if you say I'm a judge and I just say, well, Supreme Court says I don't have to pay attention to guidelines anymore, they're just advisory, I'm not going to. But I am going to give my reasons. I'm going to give my reasons for my sentence. That's not necessarily saying these are the reasons I'm going to give for giving a sentence above the guidelines or below the guidelines. It's just these are the reasons for my decision for a sentence where I'm not going to be using the guidelines. And under those circumstances, the reasons that the form lists all seem to fit, right? So they say, well, is restitution part of the reason for your sentence? Is rehabilitation part of the reason? And all those things would be perfectly legitimate reasons if they had nothing to do with increasing incarceration, right?
I suppose, Your Honor, my reading of that is somewhat different. It seems to me that the reasons are he's giving reasons for a sentence outside the advisory guideline sentence. And by outside, I've always interpreted that to mean outside the sentencing range specified, in this case, the 33 to 41 months. But if you look at the law, like especially if you look at 3553C2 and 28 U.S.C. 944, which is, of course, what mandates the completion of the statement of reasons, the court is supposed to require when he gives a sentence, and again, it maybe even tracks this language, but when he gives a sentence outside the guideline range, and by that I've always interpreted it to mean a sentence in either excess or less than what's in the guideline range, he is supposed to state his reasons for doing that with specificity in the statement of reasons, which I believe is what this document is doing. It's not to capture the reasons for the sentence itself, but it's to capture this page in particular is to capture the reasons for giving a sentence that is different than what's in the guidelines.
Sure.
Whether it's greater or lesser, but one way or the other.
Is there anything from the Sentencing Commission that explain? It seems to me there's two possible readings of this. One is the one you're suggesting, which is why didn't you follow the guidelines, Judge? And the other one is what is your reason for the sentence that you gave and give all the factors that you gave it? Does the Sentencing Commission, when they, I take it they're the ones who issued this form, do they give any further explanation, or is this all we have?
This is all we have, and then what is contained in 944, and then in the recent amendments to 3553C.
Well, 944 is before the Supreme Court had acted, so that was about upward departures.
Right. I guess in 944, it just says, you know, in saying that a statement of reasons must be completed, that a written statement of reasons for the sentence imposed, which shall include the reason for any departure from the otherwise applicable guideline range.
So that was before people were thinking about the possibility of varying the guidelines being.
I understand. I do understand that, Your Honor. And then in 3553C2, which was recently amended to make sure that the judge, anytime, and perhaps it's worthwhile to take a quick look at what that statute says. And that statute says that. This is 3553C2. The court at the time of sentencing shall state in open court the reasons for imposition of a particular sentence, and if the sentence, now skipping ahead to subparagraph 2, is not of the kind or is outside the range described by the guideline range, the specific reason for the imposition of the sentence different from that described, which must also be stated with specificity in the statement of reasons. Mm-hmm. So I read that to mean that this form is to reflect why the judge gave a sentence that was outside the guideline range. That's what I take 3553C to mean, so that when the judge did check those boxes on the statement of reasons in Section C, he was indicating his reasons for giving a sentence, not just the sentence in general, but specifically
for giving a
sentence.
If there's an inconsistency between what's said at oral sentencing and the written statement of response, what are we supposed to do with those inconsistencies?
I don't.
Doesn't our Booker opinion shed some light on that when there was a a written judgment that followed the oral sentencing, and they were in conflict. We said the oral sentencing predominates, right?
That's true, and I mean,
why does that principle apply here?
I don't think there is such a conflict. I know, Your Honor had there's the 41 months. He said 41 months is not enough punishment, but he didn't give him four. I mean, even if we say he was going to give,
then you're in the trap. If there's no ambiguity, why do we look at the statement at all?
Well, we don't know to what extent he gave him 60 months, which of course is 19 months more than 41 months. Maybe some of that was for punishment and some of that was for the impermissible factors of restitution. And there's no, that's one of my arguments.
So you think the ambiguity here is the only thing he said was that 41 months wasn't enough punishment, but as to the additional months, you think it's ambiguous as to how much of that was to increase the punishment or to accomplish other things, right?
I do think that, and I guess my instinct is not to read too much into the pronoun. I do think that's right, Your Honor, and even if Your Honor thinks that when he said 41 months is not enough punishment, he was trying to make a definitive statement, I think even if that were the case, we still don't know how much above 41 months the judge went because of punishment or because of these other factors, the restitution and the rehabilitation. But I think also when he said 41 months is not enough punishment, I'm not sure you can just divorce that out and say that he was only speaking of punishment. I mean, he was talking in the context of considering all these factors, including rehabilitation, and he blurted out 41 months is not enough punishment. I'm not sure how definitive a statement that is in and of itself, but even if Your Honors do take it as the definitive statement, it still doesn't explain how we got to the 60-month figure. It may explain how we got somewhere above 41 months, but it doesn't explain how we got to 60 months.
Yeah, on the reading again of the form, I take your point about 3553C. I think it's a good point. But the judge did click off a bunch of reasons, including restitution. So is your theory that he thought that if the defendant was in jail a very long time working for Prison Industries at 1 cent to, an hour, he would be able to pay off restitution better than if he got out of jail earlier and might be able to get a job or some other way of paying restitution?
I don't know what he was thinking, but I think he might have been thinking that, and I know the government had
a more reasonable suggestion is that's not at all what he was thinking, but he was just listing restitution as one of the things that was included in his sentence.
It could be. I mean, I don't know what the judge was thinking. I could see the judge thinking, at least if I know he's in prison working, say, in Unicor, and I've ordered him to pay restitution payable immediately, and I've also ordered him to participate in the inmate financial responsibility program, even though he won't be making very much money, I know that he will be making some money, and I know that he will be paying restitution for certain.
He owes immediately $60,000 or?
So I think 67 and some change.
So that would be like 10,000 years working for Unicor.
Right. No, he would never get it. Obviously, he would never get it paid off, but at least he would get some of it paid off within that time. And I think that is one plausible reading of what the judge was trying to do.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning. Angela Schmidt on behalf of the United States. In this plea agreement that appellant entered into, he waived his right to appeal the claims that he now raises.
But that's not what the court told him. There was a plea hearing, and at the plea hearing, it's the obligation of the judge to explain the provisions of the plea, and the judge did not say that you waived your right to plea to appeal. The judge said, you've given up your right to appeal except should you come to believe after consulting with counsel that the court has found something illegal, such as imposing a period of imprisonment longer than the statutory maximum. Now that's what that, and the assistant U.S. attorney who was there did not say anything different, did not disagree, and then later at the sentencing, the judge ends by saying, now if you don't like this, you can appeal, and again, the assistant U.S. attorney did not disagree. How can this be a voluntary and intelligent waiver if the judge tells you that you can appeal if you think something I've done is illegal?
Your Honor, let me start with your last point, which I think is addressed by this court's decision in Guillen, which basically says that whatever happens at sentencing doesn't alter the terms of the
plea. But it's consistent. It doesn't alter it because it was completely consistent with what happened at the plea.
And it's also consistent with what happened at the plea. Here's would be the government's argument, because he did retain a limited right to appeal should the judge have imposed a sentence that was illegal, in other words, if it exceeded the statutory maximum.
Well, that's,
and that's simply what the judge was explaining.
Well, I have to say I have more education than the defendant in this case, and I read this as saying to me that this is an example of the kind of illegal things. Obviously, the defendant is in a slightly different position with respect to his knowledge of the law, and it's not certainly not an unreasonable view that when somebody says you can appeal if you think I've done something illegal, such as, namely, for example, not only the following example.
But read in context, which is that the court was referring specifically to the plea agreement when it made this statement and had been had actually alerted to the plea agreement, but had asked defense counsel whether there was a waiver provision. Defense counsel pointed it out. The court, looking at that, summarized that portion.
Well, he summarized it wrong.
I don't believe, actually, Your Honor, that it is wrong, because it is.
The court's obligation is to make sure the defendant understands the plea agreement, right?
Yes.
Well, yes. How could he do that if he stated it differently than the language of the plea agreement?
We would not argue, actually. Well, if the court just is simply supposed to regurgitate the terms of the plea agreement, I don't know how informative that plea colloquy would be at all here.
Well, it's not informative if you say something different than the plea agreement. You're absolutely right. The judge should say even more to make sure it's understood, but not something that's inconsistent.
We would argue that it's not inconsistent, because imposing a sentence above the statutory maximum is something illegal. So that's what the court was explaining. To read the term such as in such an expansive way is really to impose almost an impossible burden on the court in terms of summarizing.
Really? Couldn't the court have simply said the only way you can appeal is if I impose a sentence of imprisonment longer than the statutory maximum? That's an impossible thing to say?
It's not an impossible thing to
say. Not only is it not impossible, that's what you put in the plea agreement. So it must be possible.
We're holding the court to a very high standard, and I don't think that any of the parties here construed the court's comments as reading outside the terms of the plea agreement. There certainly wasn't any suggestion that there was any confusion with respect to this waiver of the plea agreement, and the government believes that it should be enforced.
Why did the Assistant U.S. Attorney not disagree at the end of the sentencing when that was said?
At the end of the sentencing, that was a correct statement.
What was the statement?
The statement was you have a right to appeal. Mm-hmm. And he
you
did
have
a right to
appeal this sentence. That's what it said. But actually, your view is that he does not have a right to appeal this.
He had a right. Well,
I'm going to read you. It says, you have the right to appeal this sentence, page 35. Now, the government's position is you do not have a right to appeal this sentence, right?
Your Honor, I believe that the statement that was made at sentencing is no different from the statement that was made in Guillen, if I'm correct, if it's Guillen.
I'm not asking about the law. I'm asking, you said everybody understood everything. And I'm not asking about whether it makes a difference that the Assistant U.S. Attorney didn't disagree. But I want to know why the Assistant U.S. Attorney didn't disagree. When the judge says something flatly wrong, it's the obligation of representing the government to correct him, whether or not that has a legal implication later or not. That's the job of the prosecutor.
It does not appear from the context of what was said at the plea hearing that what the judge did was flatly wrong, that his summary or his paraphrase of the paragraph in the plea agreement regarding the waiver was...
I'm talking about in the sentencing here.
At the sentencing, well, this court's case law has suggested or has found that for a court to advise a defendant at the end of a sentencing hearing, even if there is a waiver of appeal in the plea agreement of a right to appeal, is not incorrect, that that's still correct. You have a right to appeal. It doesn't mean your appeal will be successful, but you have a right to appeal. For example,
that it's okay to tell somebody you have a right to appeal. All we said is that if that's inconsistent with what was said earlier, then it doesn't have a legal consequence. We didn't say it's right.
There is an exception in the plea agreement that provides for an opportunity to appeal a sentence. So what the judge said at the sentencing hearing is technically correct. I would also point out that this court doesn't enforce waivers in all circumstances. So if an appellant or a defendant believed that his waiver was unenforceable, he could certainly still appeal that. That's still a correct statement of the law. But I would like to turn...
If we think you're right on the merits of the case, do we have to deal with this issue at all?
No, I don't think that the court has to deal with the issue, but I would urge the court to consider the principles that the court set out in the West case in looking at the waiver issue, because there was a similar situation in the West case where appellant...
Sounds like if you really want us to deal with it, you might get an opinion you don't like.
Well, that's why I'm referring the court to the West case, because in the West case, there was a similar situation where the appellant had not raised in his opening brief that there was a waiver of appeal in the plea agreement. And the court in the West case espoused principles that the government would urge the court to apply here, which is simply to say, look, you can't ignore the elephant in the room. You have to address this in your opening brief. You can't hope that the government won't refer to it in its brief and then come back and reply and raise the argument.
But the government had an opportunity in this case. Usually we talk about waiver where somebody waits until the reply brief. The government had an opportunity and made a full argument about it. We've heard the argument. But to follow from Judge Tatel's question, imagine you've lost that argument. What's and this is only a footnote question, but what's the deal on the IFRP question? What is your, assuming there was no waiver and they're entitled to, he was entitled to complain about the compelled participation in IFRP, what's the government's view?
First of all, that the standard of review is plain error, because that was apparent at the time of the sentencing and no objection was raised, and that plain error hasn't been established.
Is it? Well,
because it can he doesn't want to participate in the program.
Fair enough. We'll ask him about that. But let me just back up for a second. You agree that had he objected, he couldn't be compelled to participate in IFRP?
That appears to be the case.
Okay.
If the court has any, the government's view is on the merits of this. Obviously, if the court doesn't believe that the waiver is enforceable, the government's view is that the district court's oral statements at sentencing clearly indicated that the court did not increase appellant's term of
imprisonment. What if we disagreed with that? If we thought there was some ambiguity, what do we do with the written statement later? Are we to read it in tandem with the?
Booker suggests that the written statement is a nullity if it contradicts the oral pronouncement.
I'm not saying it contradicts. I'm talking about, let's imagine there's some ambiguity at the oral sentencing. Are we then permitted to use the written statement to help clarify? I mean, the 2010 amendment suggests that the written statement is a little bit more important now than it has ever been before.
Well, the government's view, of course, is that there is no ambiguity, that it was very...
I know, that's not the question I asked. I said, let's imagine there was an ambiguity.
If there is ambiguity, the case law does support using the written statement to clarify confusion at the oral sentencing. But that just simply isn't what happened here. There was absolutely no confusion.
What do you think about Mr. Smith's argument that the language about insufficient punishment focused on the 41 months, and we don't know from what the court said, how many of the additional months were attributable to his view that he needed more punishment and his other view that he needed treatment?
His other view was expressed only in a permissible context. The treatment was only assessed in terms of what...
That's not my question. I agree with you about that. But his point is that, and when I asked him the question about whether there was I didn't think there was any ambiguity here either because of what the court said about 41 months, but he made an interesting point, which is all that really tells us is all that tells us unambiguously is that the court thought 41 months was insufficient.
But if you read the entire, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I would like to respond to
please.
The court's question,
yeah.
If permitted.
Yeah, go ahead.
The read in context of the entire sentencing hearing, it's clear that the court's focus was on punishment and deterrence and all of the permissible 3553 factors in terms of the appellant's character, the seriousness of the offense. That's why the court imposed the term of imprisonment that it did. The incomplete sentence, which included other components, obviously, such as supervised release, the treatment programs were only considered in a permissible context in the context of those sentences, or the entire sentence. It's clear from what the court said at sentencing that he did not impermissibly consider restitution or rehabilitation in order to increase the length of the sentence.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, I think you used up all your time, but you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I really have nothing to add. With the IFRP issue, I know I'd argue that in a footnote.
Do you want to be in the program or not?
I don't know.
He doesn't want to be compelled to be in the program?
I guess he doesn't want to be compelled in the program. To be honest, Your Honor, I haven't asked ask him about it.
Did you notice that the way the Seventh Circuit dealt with that in a couple of cases was that on the basis of the government's representation that it could not be mandatory, they just affirmed on that ground? In other words, they essentially modified it and affirmed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not. I didn't give the issue much thought, frankly, other than it seemed like an issue to bring up just because I noticed.
That's why it was in a footnote.
You just
demonstrated why we shouldn't read footnotes.
You're right.
On the other hand, you proved that we do read footnotes.
You do read footnotes.
But thank you. We've learned a lesson. That's the last time.
My feeling is it should be. He shouldn't be mandatorily required. Obviously, if the requirement is vacated, he can still voluntarily participate in the program. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smith, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Godoy, and we are grateful to you for your assistance. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.